Apple is waking up to a dark reality. CCP has complete control over America's most iconic company, and it all happened right in front of our eyes. You see, after many warnings, Apple tried to shift its production lines outside China. And to do this, it wanted to send its own equipment and engineers to other countries to set up the factory. After all, this is how Apple started in China. Apple equipment and engineers from the United States went to China and started factories. But for the CCP, this was a no-go. China wants company to come in, but it never wants them to leave. And Apple learned this the hard way. Just a few months ago, when it announced plans to move out of China, CCP stopped Apple equipment from shipping outside, and it also banned Apple employees from leaving the country. This is when Tim Cook realized he had made a massive mistake, and he did it all willingly. To find out how CCP got control of Apple, I decided to talk to the author of a new book, Apple in China, Patrick McGee. What's up, everyone? Today, I have none other than Patrick McGee. He's a journalist and the author of one of my favorite books, Apple in China, one of the best-selling books according to New York Times. And this book was truly very, very shocking when I found it, because we've been covering a lot of this on our channel for, I would say, last 5 years. And your book provides a lot more proof than we have ever had as to how much of the role American companies have played, and specifically Apple has played in building up China, which I know when you said it, a lot of people were shocked, where people think China built Apple, but it's almost as much true that Apple built China. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy thing to say, and I get that. It's hard not to give the long-winded answer because I don't like the short answer, right? The short answer gets, it's easy to parody or whatever because I'm obviously simplifying so much. But the shortest answer I could give is that if you understand how Apple designs its products, then you get that they need to be built in a different way. If you think about a PC in the late 1990s, it was designed in such a boring way that if you accidentally put on a panel backwards or upside down, like, it would still fit. And that was part of the design, right? It was designed to be idiot proof in terms of how you made it. Nothing about Apple products is idiot proof. And so when Apple eventually moves to China, and this is like a 7-year process between 1996 and 2003, they are chasing quality. They are not chasing cost. Everybody else is in China because of cost. But Apple is upending how computers are designed, and ipso facto, they are upending how they are built. And what they recognize is that the low labor rates, the ubiquity of labor, doesn't just help you in terms of cost and margin. It gives you unconstrained design potential to sort of design something however Johnny Ive or Steve Jobs see fit, and with an army of laborers working in football-sized factories on a conveyor belt production line, they can come up with methods of production and manufacturing that nobody else is thinking of. And that's how you get something like the first iPod, and then the miniaturization into the Mini, and then the further miniaturization into the iPhone. Into the iPod Nano. But yeah, then into the iPhone, right? The iPhone is as much a first generation phone as it is a sixth generation iPod. And the design breakthroughs are fundamental, of course, and that's the narrative we know. What my book contributes to is an understanding that the operational breakthroughs are just as foundational, and for reasons that are kind of strange and hard to explain, we've ignored them.
Yeah, and I think your book quantifies something that I've been kind of saying, and I don't know if you remember, but in 2017, Tim Cook was at some stage and he was asked about China. Why is Apple in China? And he basically gave this answer where it's like, it has nothing to do with low-cost labor. He's like, it has everything to do with engineers. You have a lot of engineers in China, and that's why Apple is in China. And my thinking with that kind of quote was like, if I have a company that's taking advantage of low cost in China, I will never publicly admit. I will say like, oh, it's all the other things. That's why we're doing it. It's not because of this big thing. But your book actually said what Tim Cook said. That's the good part about like it. Great line. There's some truth to it. China has a lot of engineers, but Apple played a gigantic role in making that possible, right?
Now, before we get into the answer, just a quick request from everyone watching to hit that like and subscribe button down below. It really does help us out tremendously in fighting the CCP bots who downvote any video that criticizes the communist government. Now, let's get into the answer.
Yeah, I would largely defend what Tim Cook said, which is that in 2017, China was not the lowest cost of labor in the world. I mean, if you were just chasing low labor, there's plenty of other places you could go because labor rates in China had really ratcheted up. It really was the development of skill. What he leaves out is that Apple was the teacher, right? So Apple, I've compared to a vocational school in China. I mean, you think of how many kids go to Harvard each year. I don't think it's tens of thousands, right? My university was tens of thousands. It's a few thousand, and yet they have this huge impact. Well, Apple, since 2008, has trained 30 million people. That's how many people have been on some facet of the production line or assembly process or working for a supplier, working hand in glove with Apple. And so when Apple chases quality instead of cost, the massive sort of second order, third order impact of that decision is training up a whole team of engineers in China, because China doesn't have the tech competence in the late 90s, early 2000s to respond to what Apple is demanding. And so the sort of decision that gets made is we'll go train the workforces so that they can meet our demand. That's a decision made when Apple's a pretty small company. I mean, they almost go bankrupt in 96, 97, and again in 2000. These are the years of them experimenting with outsourcers for the first real time, at least in terms of a strategic sense. And that lays the groundwork for them to be successful. But then, like, the real impact is once iPhones come out, and within a matter of 5-6 years, they go from 5 million a year to 100 million a year, and then eventually to 230 million a year. And if you understand the perfectionist, no tolerance for defects culture that Apple is famous for, and you transplant that into hundreds of factories against in China to build at the level that's required of doing a quarter billion iPhones a year, then you can begin to understand that, okay, they had to just upend and do training, engineering 101, to just reams and reams of factories, each housing thousands upon thousands of employees. Zhengzhou alone, iPhone City, has 400,000 employees. The impact is literally that of a nation-building effort. I mean, it sounds like a crazy claim, but this is a slow-burn argument taking place over 400 pages. I've yet to meet someone who's read the whole book and think the figures don't make sense.
And also, like, it is a crazy claim, and it's also, I think, most people don't comprehend how big of a scale Apple itself is. Because I looked up before we hopped on the podcast, Apple is $3.39 trillion. People can't comprehend billion. Apple's market cap is bigger than UK's GDP. So it's a huge company. And some interesting stories I looked up, because I know audience-wise it's interesting. Apple was able to work with major airlines in the United States to create routes that only Apple employees used every single day for, like, I don't even know how many years. They were spending like $200 million a year on airline fees.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you that story because that's a funny one. So, you know, people would count the number of industries that Steve Jobs had disrupted as CEO, right? And you could sort of do the similar thing for Tim Cook to maybe, you know, now that they pushed into, you know, a Netflix-style streaming service and stuff, like you throw TV into the mix or whatever. And I think airlines is a possible one that you could add to the mix. So in 2014 and 2016, Apple was sending so many engineers to China that they had to convince United Airlines to start flying to Chengdu and start flying to Hangzhou, places where they had never flown before. But Apple needed so many seats that they said, we need you to fly there 3 times a week. And it doesn't matter if the rest of the plane is empty. We will buy so many first class seats that you'll still be profitable. And United, you know, begins those flights.
Which is insane, right? I know we talked about before that you've been talking about these stories, but I think audience is going to be shocked. And even personally, like, these stories are why, like, I tell to every guest that I'm excited to talk to them, which I am. But this one is like, we don't know each other, but these stories are just like so interesting that I was truly excited. Now, so,
well,
go ahead.
The other funny thing that comes out of that is I would talk to someone that, let's say, worked for Google doing the Pixel, or worked for Motorola back in the day, and they would say occasionally they would fly over to China. So they would be flying first class as, you know, part of this big company. And basically, they would be the only Motorola, the only Google employee on the flight, and everybody else in first class was an Apple employee, right? I mean, like, anyone involved in this business knows that Apple operates with a level of minutiae, dedication, and sort of man hours on the ground in China that nobody else has. And, you know, today there are thousands upon thousands of people just working for Apple full time in China. And so the flights have actually diminished to some extent. But just to understand, like, the process of taking our designs and having them scale, but having them scale at a time when we're at a level which we retain the control, right? Like, I compare Apple to Uber in the sense that Uber is the largest taxi provider in the world without owning any real estate. Apple figures out how to be the biggest manufacturer in the world without owning any factories, but they don't do so by sending specs over to just some competent supplier who can carry it out. They build that competence and they oversee it. And the operators in China at some other company are using machinery that Apple has either purchased or sort of like given to them through a loan program to allow them to operate not just beyond their perceived capabilities, but their actual capabilities, because especially 25 years ago, the Chinese entities didn't have the money for these kinds of machines, but Apple did.
Yeah. And actually, I have a very interesting story about Uber, Apple, and China. Hopefully you haven't heard that story, because it's always interesting to tell people stories they haven't heard. But for the audience, they'll have to stick around because we'll talk about it later. Now, talking about, that's YouTube retention.
Yeah.
Talking about stories, we talked about this before the podcast too. You know how Steve Jobs shares this story? And I don't know if it's true where he, not Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos shares this story where he saw some stats about internet and he's like, I have to get involved. And that kind of led to like the founding of Amazon. If I'm correct, based on my research, you spent 2 years researching for this book, correct? And what was something that convinced you like, oh, this is interesting topic? Because it clearly is really interesting now that you're done. But like, what got you started?
So it wasn't a number. The numbers, as I understood them, came later. It was, in a sense, an embarrassment of my own ignorance of how Apple makes its products. I mean, when I was telling people in the earliest stages that I was getting interested in this as a topic, the answer would usually be like, well, what do you mean? Apple makes its products in China. Everybody knows that. But then you just ask them any other questions, like name some of the suppliers, how did they get into it? What did China offer that, you know, Taiwan or Japan or something didn't offer? And nobody sort of had any answers. And so to some extent, this came out of a conversation where somebody was explaining what a chip maker was doing in Taiwan and how difficult it was because of the COVID restrictions. And I said, right, but it's a chip designer, right? Like by nature, it's fabless. They don't build the chips. So why do they need to go to Taiwan? And in retrospect, that's a very naive question, because to understand chip design is to understand that they absolutely go into the factories and do some hand-holding and help. And there's a sort of congruence of the chip designers. And
when you say they, who do you mean? Apple or someone else?
I'm trying not to give the name.
Okay.
So let's just say someone along the lines of an Apple that does design chips, a Qualcomm that designs chips, an NVIDIA that designs chips, right? But they don't make them, right? All those chips that I just mentioned get made by TSMC. But people from those companies are in TSMC helping to build the chips. I didn't know that. And so the person, upon recognizing that I didn't know that, said, well, it's just like Apple. And I remember thinking, Apple goes into the factories? Like, this was a novel idea to me. And I was 3 years into being an Apple reporter. And so trying to educate myself, I was like, you know, what are the books about this that I haven't read, right? What are the lengthy magazine articles that I haven't read? And there was a sort of quick recognition that like, this wasn't widely known and this had not been written about. And so that was the impetus to the story, that not only did we not really understand how Apple was manufacturing in China by orchestrating everything to like a really minute level, but people also didn't understand sort of when they had gone to China, what the earliest projects were, certainly not the influence and impact that they had, but also they didn't understand things like, and I didn't understand things like, the candy-colored iMac was built out of Korea by LG, which ironically wasn't even a contract manufacturer. Apple's just so powerful, they sort of made them a contract manufacturer, but they were just their provider of analog monitors. And then LG expanded to building them in Mexico and in Wales. And I was just thinking like, there's this whole other side of Apple that I don't understand, and I'm an Apple reporter. And if I don't understand it, other people aren't gonna understand it as well. So it wasn't just like, there's an understanding of, hey, I could really delve into how Apple products are made. There was an early realization that there were three books that could be combined into one, because the three books that hadn't been written about Apple are, one, how did it go from being days away from bankruptcy to being the world's most valuable company? Even if I define that, let's say, as $1 trillion in 2019, or even $350 billion in 2011 at the time of Steve Jobs' death, other than biographies of Johnny Ive, of Tim Cook, of Steve Jobs, there just is no standard history that sort of takes you through 15 years of 1996 to 2011 in terms of the products. So that was bizarre, right? Don't you feel like there should be 5 or 6 books on that topic? It should almost be a cliche business school case study at this point, and it doesn't exist. That's book one. Book two is, how do they actually manufacture their products? I mean, after all, it's the world's most valuable company. Most of us have, you know, thousands of dollars worth of Apple stuff, right, somewhere in our home. And yet they go from manufacturing almost everything themselves in the late 70s, throughout the 80s, throughout the 90s, to orchestrating it all and not manufacturing anything themselves. I mean, that alone is a really consequential shift for the world's most iconic company. Where's the book just on that? And that didn't exist. And then the third thing is, when they make that shift, they eventually find China. But China's an authoritarian country. You don't just build stores on a nice corner place of Shanghai without a bunch of political connections. So who are the players in China working for Apple, making those political connections? What are the quid pro quos? What are the investments and so forth? That was another book to be written. And so the idea for the book was never, why don't I take what's already been written and pad it out with, like, you know, some great writing? It was, why don't I compress 3 books worth of novel content into one book such that every page is new information? And so there's some stuff that has been written in the Walter Isaacson biography, let's say, that is quite helpful for my narrative, and I avoid it just because I want your average Apple nerd to be in a Barnes & Noble just deciding based on the cover to look through the book, and for any page they go on for them to read and be like, I don't know what this is, right? That's how packed full of novel information I wanted it to be. I thought if they opened the page and I was actually just recounting what Walter Isaacson said, they'd be like, I'm done with this, I don't care. And so the sort of challenge I set for myself was that essentially every page of the book was novel information. And I'll let readers decide whether I've done that. But from my perspective, it packed full of new insight.
No, it is. And on top of, like, our audience likes business and likes geopolitics, it's like one of the rare books that covers the intersection of both, especially relating to China. So I think if you enjoy the podcast, you should definitely check out the book. And just a quick recap, because a lot of people probably haven't watched the video we made. So Apple was struggling, Steve Jobs comes back, but Apple was already on the move towards, like, outsourcing manufacturing overseas, right? And I think this is your words, maybe I'm misremembering it, where they were struggling because they were competing on logistics, and that's not what Apple was built on. They were built on innovation, and that's what, I guess that's why they brought back Steve Jobs. Maybe I'm misspeaking. But that's my thing.
Yeah, not quite. It's more that, so the guy who is just before Steve Jobs, he lasts 500 days at the company, and he's known as a turnaround artist. His name is Gil Amelio. And he sort of looks at the company and thinks, okay, the problem here is sort of inefficiency, and that if we can sort of streamline operations and save money that way, then, you know, I'm going to get this company back. It's kind of like an okay conclusion, but it's ass backward. Essentially, what he's thinking is that if we operate more like the PC industry, we'll be able to compete with them. But you were taking the strengths of the PC market and saying that little old Apple, 3% of the market, is going to take them on. But Apple products aren't designed with interchangeable parts, standardized parts. So you were never going to compete in that level. And so they have to differentiate. They have to operate and do something different. So it's not really, in the early stages, an operations story. It's more about, like, iMovie, right? It's more about iTunes. It's more about the aesthetics of the computer and a new great all-in-one system that connects to the internet really fast and has, you know, a single cord rather than this, like, just a mess of cords that people would have for the PC. So it's about simplicity. And so it's about the stuff that Steve Jobs cares about. But Gil Amelio didn't really understand that. Steve Jobs is brought back because the other thing that Gil Amelio is suffering from is that the operating system at Apple is a total mess. And so he acquires Steve Jobs' company called Next, which in a sense is its own kind of failure, but it did have, like, a sort of cutting edge operating system, right? The OS. The trouble was it wasn't a market fit because it had such a small share of the computer market. It really didn't matter how good it was. It wasn't sort of interchangeable, if you will, with the rest of the computer market. You know, you couldn't rely on anyone else having a Next computer. So it was sort of never going to take off. And the company was basically failing. And Steve Jobs had largely moved on to Pixar, where he was overseeing the launch of Toy Story and stuff, right? I think some people have forgotten the story, but he was the CEO of Pixar as well. But anyway, it's like the combination of these two flailing companies that actually leads to Apple, right, being a fantastic company. And Steve Jobs isn't the CEO when he comes into Apple, right? He's basically just an advisor to Emilio. But eventually he sells all but one of the 1.5 million shares that he was given as part of the deal as a sign of, I don't think Emilio is the right leader. Even though he denied it at the time, it was clear to the board what had happened. So Gil Emilio gets ousted and Steve Jobs is offered the role of CEO. Now, what's really interesting about this is he had never been CEO before. Most people think that he must have been the CEO in the 70s or 80s because he founded the company. That's not the case. He had never been the CEO. He was like 21 years old when he founded the company. So there was an early recognition that he shouldn't be the CEO because he had no experience. And once he's eventually ousted in 1985 by the CEO that he had appointed, John Sculley, you know, he goes off essentially for 12 years. So when he comes back to Apple, he has been CEO. He's the CEO of Pixar. He'd been the CEO of Next, but he'd never been the CEO of Apple. And the riddle that I had to solve was, why doesn't he take this role when he's given it to him? After all, he founded the company, right? And you think of Apple's success today, you think if you had the opportunity to take that role, of course you would take it. And the answer was revealed essentially by some people that worked with him at the time. But also I was able to get notes that had never been published before. I'm the only person, as far as I know, that even has these notes, where Steve Jobs explains basically to his team that he thinks Apple's about to fail. He doesn't see how they come out of this. And the thing that changes is he goes to meet Johnny Ive for the first time, and there's a meeting of the minds. And ironically, Johnny Ive shows up at the meeting with his resignation letter in his back pocket. He expects to quit. And Jobs has called the meeting effectively to fire Johnny Ive, because if you look at Apple products that existed at the time, well, whoever's designing them doesn't know what he's doing because all these products suck, right? That's sort of the Steve Jobs perspective. And then he goes there and Johnny Ive and his team of ID, industrial designers, have basically like put out this presentation of all the things they've been working on. And Jobs recognizes that Apple executives before him thought of their design abilities as an irritant rather than the pathway to redefining the company. And the idea of the iMac is basically born in this meeting and in subsequent meetings. And this is what convinces Jobs. This is a company that can be saved. If we play our cards right, Apple can be saved. And the Think Different campaign launches, or like is conceived within a few days of that meeting, maybe a few weeks. And a few weeks later, Steve Jobs accepts the role of interim CEO. And then they begin working on the iMac, and it comes out within the next year and it becomes America's best-selling computer. So until you have the idea of the iMac, Steve Jobs doesn't think the company can be saved. And the meeting with Johnny Ive changes everything.
Great story. I actually researched a lot. I don't think you'll share that story. So that's a great, great background for the audience. I didn't know they even needed it. But okay, so definitely Steve Jobs comes in. He's like the innovative leader and people see him even today, right? That way. But the other part of Apple that people don't realize is they're also like a logistic juggernaut. And big part of that is Tim Cook. All part of that is Tim Cook. I don't know how would you put it. And why did Tim Cook come over? Because he just had taken a job as a VP at some other company. Why did he come over and what kind of role did he play?
Yeah, not just some other company, but at Compaq. Now, Compaq doesn't really exist anymore. So it's like, who cares about Compaq? But at the time, they were king of the clones. They made more PCs, or at least earned more revenue in PCs than anybody else on the planet. They were one of the first companies to clone the IBM PC. And by 1998, they were the leader. Tim Cook had basically just gone there. But if you think of what he can do, right, he's an operational wizard. Well, how much can you help the company that's already the leader in PCs? You're probably just sort of helping at the margins at that point. So when he's offered the role at Apple, I mean, my God, it wouldn't take much questions or, you know, much reading to realize that Apple is just a total mess. And so think of the contributions you can make if your skill set is operational wizardry and what you're being given is a company just in total decline. Well, you can just make a massive impact. And so, you know, Tim Cook is this like kind of like cold or at least cool, even-tempered, even-keeled guy. But what's interesting is that he very much gets lured in an almost a mystical sense by Steve Jobs. He's really taken by Steve Jobs. And so he has this interview to Charlie Rose where he basically said all the rational parts of my brain were saying, well, of course, this is a bad move. Like, why would you do this? But he couldn't ignore his gut that just said, go west, young man, go west. And so the meeting of the minds, if you will, between Tim Cook and Steve Jobs is absolutely foundational to the company, because without someone with the operational prowess of Tim Cook, and we'll get to this later, but of Terry Guo of Foxconn, you know, Apple would just be known as a company that made really cool products that no one purchased. But hey, if you want to go to MoMA in New York, you know, we can go see what they looked like. You know, until you have the operational wizardry, they're not going to be affordable and they're not going to be in the mass market. And so you can't really understate the operational culture of Apple. And I think the best thing, I don't know that anybody would be skeptical at this point of what I'm saying here, but everybody was skeptical in 2011, which is when Tim Cook is made CEO. And I would just ask people to reflect on that. When Steve Jobs dies, the unilateral person who is taking over is Tim Cook. And just think of what that means. I mean, people have said for years that Tim Cook isn't a product guy and used this as a slight against him. But the thing is he was appointed by Steve Jobs, the ultimate product guy. So it's always been a lazy criticism, because if Steve Jobs had confidence in Tim Cook, then what it tells you was that Steve Jobs already believed Apple had created the best products on the planet. Now what we needed to do was iterate and improve them and scale them and distribute them at high margin and at a world-leading scale. And that's why Tim Cook is chosen as CEO. Just to get ahead of myself, I think it does matter now that Tim Cook isn't a product guy, because for the first time since the death of Steve Jobs, you do have insane innovation coming out of companies like Perplexity, Anthropic, OpenAI, even Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft is somehow doing cooler presentations than Apple. I mean, think of the I'm a PC, I'm a Mac ads from 15 years ago and try to get your head around the fact that the tables have turned a little bit. So I think, you know, Apple's future is very much dependent on its competencies, not in logistics and operations, which they sort of nailed, but down to product vision, product design, and AI. And Tim Cook just has a skill set useful for a different era of Apple. And the sooner that Apple's board recognizes that we're in a new era, the sooner they should recognize that, you know, give Tim Cook $1 billion and a nice golden plaque, but he's not the guy to lead Apple into the next era.
For sure. And we'll now go into like the geopolitics shifts that are happening around the world, China getting into the World Trade Organization. But since you know a lot about Apple, I had an interesting question. Who played a bigger role in Apple becoming a $3 trillion company? Steve Jobs or Tim Cook? In your opinion, of course.
I almost don't like the question because it's unanswerable. It's a fair question, but let me sort of put it in different terms. Sometimes people will say Tim Cook is clearly the better CEO because he took a $350 billion company and he 10x'd it. So, you know, if the first $350 billion is a result of Steve Jobs, then the next $2.7 trillion is the result of Tim Cook. I think that's really unfair to Steve Jobs. What I would say is Steve Jobs took a $3 billion company and made it worth more than $300 billion. So he 100x'd the valuation of Apple. And by contrast, Tim Cook only 10x'd it, right? I mean, that's how you could sort of put it. So it's sort of an unfair comparison. But of course, really the magic of Apple is both those things, right? So one of the top lines in the book, and I say this because my wife wrote it rather than me, is the meeting of the minds between Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs made Apple products unique, but it was Terry Guo and Tim Cook who made them ubiquitous. You don't get Apple without both of those teams.
That makes sense. And now we get to 2000. And I know you have said it too. We can't blame Apple for going into China. Our leaders were pushing almost every company to go into China. China had just gotten into the WTO. And is this when they partnered with Foxconn already? But okay, so the question is, was it Foxconn who went into China and Apple was like, we trust you, we'll go with you? Or was it Apple pushing Foxconn to go into China?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, so Foxconn is born in a shed in Taiwan in 1974. And there's this really interesting history of all these Taiwanese companies, including Foxconn, setting up shop as soon as it's legal in China, which I believe is 1987. So Quanta and Ventec, Foxconn, these are all these Taiwanese companies who basically look at their own country, Taiwan, population 20 million or so, and see, you know, rising labor costs, capital constraint, a whole host of issues. Basically, just the island's too small for them to sort of keep up with world-leading demand that they're getting from the PC industry. And so on their own volition, they go set up shop in China, where, of course, they speak the language, and they can sort of take advantage of vast pools of labor. Maybe we don't want to get to too much detail here, but one thing that's really interesting is that as much as contract manufacturers chase cost, and that's why you go from sort of one developing country to another, you know, think of someone like Nike. If you had like a stack of Jordans in front of you from, you know, 1994 or something all the way to the present, you would notice that the tag keeps changing, right? Sometimes it's Malaysia, sometimes it's Bangladesh, sometimes it's Vietnam, sometimes it's Taiwan. And they're really chasing sort of like the low labor around the world. So there's a story of globalization just through the Air Jordan. I mean, that's not a bad idea for a book, to be honest. Just came up with it, but I like that idea.
Someone should write that.
Possibly that's what I write. Okay.
But Apple doesn't chase cost. They chase quality.
Quality engineering isn't something that one just grows up learning. You need to be taught. And so there's this interesting history after World War II where America has more than 50% capacity of manufacturing. And they basically developed this system to distribute some of that knowledge around the world to, in a sense, create a new world order, right? Based on intercommerce, based on trade, based on commerce, et cetera. And so, you know, you think of the fact that World War II had just been fought between, obviously, I'm only talking about one field, America and Japan. But just after the war, America begins sending engineers over to Japan to teach them so that they can build a radar industry. And that sort of turns into the electronics industry. And Japan, by the 70s, is like a leader in making memory chips, for instance. It's the Japanese who, faced with their own capital constraints, labor constraints, et cetera, they go begin teaching their former colonies, South Korea and Taiwan, how to manufacture. So that's how you get sort of quality going from America, going to Japan, going to these other Asian countries. And Taiwan, in a sense, basically replicates the model and takes it over to China. And now, just to fast forward, the natural place for things to flow is to India. But China is basically putting up blockers, right? It's blocking visas from Chinese people that could go to India, and it's blocking the export of machinery. So there's sort of like a quote-unquote natural order of how this stuff gets taught and goes from country to country. But the problem is China has seen this movement before. It's benefited from being a participant in this movie, and it doesn't want to lose it. I mean, Xi Jinping has basically directly said, what's the quote? China will never deindustrialize, right? It sees the value, and it has this sort of Nietzschean will to power. Anyway, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, but the fact is the suppliers in the PC value chain that are going to China. It is not Apple making a distinct decision. Hey, why don't we go to China? Has anyone thought of that? No. Everybody's going to China. And because Apple's no longer making their own products, they're relying on contract manufacturers, they're relying on suppliers. It's the suppliers themselves that are going there because of the low cost. But again, because China doesn't have the competence to respond to Apple's demands, Apple begins sending people to China, just as they had done in Korea, just as they had done in Taiwan, Mexico, Czech Republic, a bunch of other places, the 7-year narrative in the book. They begin to train people on how to meet Apple's standards, and in particular, how to meet those standards even as you scale. So Steve Jobs famously cares about what the back of the computer looks like, indeed what the color of the cords inside the computer looks like. That's like not even an engineering mindset, that's a cultural mindset. And you have to transplant those ideas, that vision, into what becomes hundreds of factories in China. That's how Apple ends up having like a nation-building influence in the country.
For sure. And now shifting to the geopolitics a little bit, it wasn't a bad idea where the leaders were thinking like China coming into the WTO, it will grow, it will become a wealthier nation. So they will have to basically open up, take on democracy, capitalism, stuff like that. And I think you argue the idea wasn't bad. The fact that we were just so open about it. It's like, we're coming in, we're going to take down the party. Like everyone's just going on national TV, just talking about it.
Well, it's funny. This is what's happening today, right? Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, is sort of telling China, we want you to be dependent on the tech stack built in America of NVIDIA chips, because you won't develop your own semiconductor makers if you're reliant on our technology.
Part two of this conversation is available on our brand new podcast channel that you can watch right now by clicking the end screen on your screen. Be sure to hit the subscribe button on that channel because we'll be publishing a lot more podcasts like this one.